Vice President Biden's cancer moonshot, funneling money and talent into a cure for cancer, got a lot of researchers excited. Then there's President Obama's precision medicine initiative. It calls for research into other diseases and individual medical treatments because treatment is no longer one size fits all. So how would you do that? Well, let's check in with Eric Lander, founding director of the Broad Institute, the biomedical and genomic research center that was recently recognized by the president for three projects that fall under the Precision Medicine Initiative. Dr. Lander, Eric, welcome back.
Great to be here, Robin.
So what's not working and what would you change?
Well, in the 20th century, science was about individual scientists working at their bench on some individual protein or gene or detail. But to really take on disease, it's going to take whole new kinds of partnerships across scientists and different institutions and countries, and especially with patients. I'll give you an example. Schizophrenia is a devastating disease. It affects young adults in their late teens and 20s. It was defined about 100 years ago, but nobody understood what was the biological basis of schizophrenia. We had some drugs that treated some symptoms rather poorly, but what caused it? So the genetics that came out of the Human Genome Project in principle meant you might be able to discover what those genes were, but you had to look at a lot of patients. So there's an initial collaboration to look at 6,000 patients and look at the genetics, and it found absolutely nothing. Pretty disappointing. But it turned out if you look closely, you could tell there was kind of some signal in the data, but you couldn't read it out. So what happened then was really remarkable. A collaboration came together involving investigators in 30 countries around the world, looking at more than 110,000 samples. And what it gave rise to a year and a half ago is the discovery of more than 100 different genes, places in the human DNA that are connected with schizophrenia. And then just this past January, the top finding of that was cracked open, and we now know what the gene does. It's a particular gene that encodes a protein that's involved in pruning the synaptic connections in the brain, particularly around adolescence. But we'd never be there without the global village. This couldn't be done in any lab.
But are you suggesting then that, I mean, some people might already think that there is a sort of big machine somewhere that's collecting data from around the world and analyzing it?
No, there's nothing like that at all. The biomedical model largely in the last century was a lot of individual labs working in parallel. And the ability to pool data, well, of course, before you had an internet, you couldn't even think about pooling data. But there are a lot of other problems in thinking about how you'd pool data. How do you get data in the first place? Even if patients wanted to share their data, how would they be able to do that? How would you pool it while keeping it safe and protecting privacy? But just think of what could happen. I'll take cancer. What do we really want 20 years from now? We want that anybody who has cancer goes into their doctor, and their doctor is able to look at a sample from their tumor and read out the DNA and go to a big imaginary wall chart there and say, all right, what genetic changes in that tumor are causing it to be a cancer? That's number one. Number two, where could I hit that tumor in order to make it stop growing? Number three, when I hit it, how's it going to find a way to become resistant? And then number four, what combination of punches can I throw so it never becomes resistant, so it never gets up off the ground? It sounds so ridiculously simple. What's driving it? Where can I hit it? How does it become resistant? How do I make a combination so it can't become resistant? But that requires a massive amount of data. We have to learn the experiences, learn from the experiences of tens of thousands of patients. And there's just no way currently to do that.
Is that because there's not the will or not the money or not the technology?
Well, the will, I think, is clear. If you ask cancer patients, would they like to share their data so it would make a difference for maybe themselves, but certainly for others going forward, 95% of cancer patients say, absolutely. Where do I sign up? Yeah, we want to have every cancer patient be able to check a box. I call it the count me in box. Count me in. I want to share my data. But it's not so easy to do. They can check the box, but then it's very hard to get your data out. It's not because the hospital necessarily doesn't want to give it to you. It's because these electronic medical record systems make it hard to get the data out. And then if you got it out, it's very hard to combine it from different places because places use incompatible systems. And then if you want to share it with researchers, well, how are you going to do that? How do you give access to, you know, researchers in general? So we began a project, and this is work of two fantastic people, Corey Painter, who's herself a survivor of cancer, and a physician at the Dana-Farber, Nick Wagley. What they did was they said, let's try it out for metastatic breast cancer and see if we can't make a collaboration of people, of patients, anywhere in the United States to try to work together to unravel the problem with metastatic breast cancer. There's about, oh, maybe 200,000 women a year who are diagnosed with breast cancer, and about 10% of them have metastatic breast cancer. So that's maybe 40,000 new cases a year, and almost all the death from breast cancer is when it metastasizes.
I was just going to say, metastatic means
it's
moving on.
It's spread in the body.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, the non-metastatic form you can remove surgically usually. Mm-hmm. So you might think, why don't we know everything about metastatic breast cancer? What's the problem? Well, here's the problem. Even though it's maybe 40,000 people a year, only a small fraction of them are treated at major academic medical centers. And any given medical center has only a small fraction of patients. The Dana-Farber, for example.
Right here in Boston.
Right here in Boston at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Nick Wagley was trying to collect patients with metastatic breast cancer to study why do some of them respond to one drug very well and not some other drug, and what's going on when it changes in some way. Well, he was able to collect about 40 patients a year. 3 years, he got himself 120 patients, which is a very small number if you're going to study a particular response that maybe a small number of them have. So instead, the idea was this. Why not involve everybody? So Nick and Corey reached out to all the organizations, about a dozen of them, who support women with metastatic breast cancer and said, let's create a metastatic breast cancer project where anybody in the country, maybe they just live in Lake Tahoe, they're able to go on the web and say, here's some information about me. I'm willing to contribute my samples, and please make me part of the project. And they designed websites, and they got all this input from patients. And then in October, they turned it on. And what they found was there was an enormous response. 1,600 people have signed up to be part of the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project. It's 15 times more than had been gathered in 3 years at the Dana-Farber.
Is there a danger, too, that you have all sorts of data and you don't know what to do with it? You get ahead of yourself. And I'm thinking of Gina Coletta's piece recently in the New York Times. There was a woman who had gone in for radiation for her breast cancer. The doctor says, oh, you have a gene mutation. That gene might then spread the cancer. And she goes to another doctor and says, oh, no, you have the gene mutation, but it doesn't mean that.
And right, it's just the opposite.
A third doctor.
Right.
And finally, they all said, you decide what you want to do. Well, what a terrible thing.
That's exactly right. And that's why we have to do this, because how are you ever going to know what it means when you see a particular genetic spelling difference in a cancer? You're only going to know by looking at real experiences of patients. The reason those doctors in the New York Times story didn't know was because nobody had collected enough data to tell. I mean, look, I think it's a crime that we don't collect this information. Every patient has precious information, and the idea that that should be lost is just a crime.
Money. Who pays for this?
Well, it's an important question. I think it's great that the federal government has tried to launch some of these initiatives. But the truth is we're underinvesting in all of this. We really need to find ways to invest in creating this information commons where we can protect people's information but gather enough of this information. And I'm pleased that the last year, finally we're seeing the budget for the National Institutes of Health begin to grow. We had almost a decade when it was flat, and it drove away a lot of young scientists. Now we've got a generation of people with great imaginations and great excitement about this. We got 1 year experience of seeing that NIH budget grow. If that happens for another year and another couple of years, I think we're going to see people really try to take on these incredibly important projects. So the timing couldn't be better.
And it's not as if we haven't done it before. We have fingerprint banks.
Oh, we have all sorts of things. We have a way to you can check on your driver's license. Count me in. I want to donate my organ if something mm-hmm. should happen. Why shouldn't a patient say, count me in and let me share my data? Please take my tumor and use
it. Take it now.
But it's a tremendous amount of work. It's building trust with patients.
Eric, thank you.
Robin, pleasure to be back here.